You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.
Well, thank you for inviting me here. I've heard about these wonderful evenings, and it's a great honor to be here tonight. Well, where people have said to me, did you realize how apposite your book was going to be? And my reply was, well, there's usually something. A little while ago, it would have been Gaza that we would have been thinking about. But as we look at ISIL, or ISIS, whatever they're calling themselves this week, there's a certain sense of exasperation in some quarters. Why on earth can't the Muslims learn to separate religion and politics? This has become the separation of these two things is now so deeply entrenched in our secular consciousness that it's very difficult for us to understand that other cultures don't have anything like this, our view of religion. Our view of religion that sees it as a series of rituals and obligatory beliefs centering on a supernatural God and entirely separate from other activities. The Oxford Classical Dictionary firmly states that there is no word in either Greek or Latin that corresponds to the English religion or religious. The rabbis in the Talmud had no conception of religion as an abstraction. For them, in the Talmud, they wanted to bring the whole of life into the ambit of the sacred and would not have understood the secular at all. The words that we translate as religion in other languages almost invariably have a much wider and more inclusive frame of reference. Din in Arabic does not mean religion in that sense, it means an entire way of life. And dharma in Sanskrit it includes law and social life and commerce and politics, as well as the service of the gods. So our view of religion, which was an absolute revolution in the 18th century, late 17th, 18th century, and it was as innovative and as experimental as the market economy that we were developing at this time. Jesus would have had no idea of a secular establishment. When he said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, he was using the Greek apodote, give it back. In first century Palestine, nearly all the uprisings in Rome were predicated on the belief that the whole of the land of Israel and its produce belonged to God and not to Rome. And so when you take that view, there's precious little to give back to Caesar. And when Jesus went into the temple and cast out the money changers and threw over their temples, he was not, as is often said, pleading for a more spiritual form of religion. He was, the temple had long been the site of the imperial administration for about 500 years in Palestine, and the tribute collected in kind from the people was stored in the temple precincts. And hence, that's why Jesus called it a den of robbers. That doesn't mean to say that Jesus was really all about politics and not about religion. He would not have seen the two as entirely distinct. And the Quran's central message is not a doctrine. The Quran is very, very scathing about theology. It calls it zanna, self-indulgent guesswork, about matters that nobody can be certain about one way or the other, but which makes people quarrelsome and stupidly sectarian. The bedrock message of the Quran is that it's good to share your wealth fairly, that it's wrong to hoard a private fortune, and the aim of life is to build a just and decent society where vulnerable people are treated with equity and respect. It's a political message. Now, that doesn't mean that people were just using religion, because the effort to create a just and decent society demanded an eternal and ever-present transcendence of the self. If any of you have ever tried to live in a religious community, as I've had, you'll know it can be a very abrasive experience that chips away at your ego day by day. And that's chipping away at the ego, which is what holds us back from what we call Brahman or Tao or God, is what people are striving for in yoga and various other spiritualities. So it is a spiritual experience. The only religion or religious tradition that actually fits the modern profile of religion as a separate activity is Protestant Christianity. And hence, in the West, we often see Protestant Christianity as the kind of benchmark on which we sort of judge all others. So people are often telling me, well, Buddhism and Confucianism are not really religions, they're secular ideologies. Well, that's not something that either the Buddha or Confucius would have understood. And certainly I would agree with them that neither Buddhism nor Confucianism is anything like Protestant Christianity. But Protestant Christianity is rather the oddball out here. And Protestant Christianity was a product, like our view of religion, of the early modern period. So let's just look quickly at the Crusades. It's a great thing always brought up about how, you know, the evils and the violent passions unleashed in by religion. Well, certainly religious passions were involved. I'm not saying that that they are not in the picture at all, but there were equally political issues at stake. The Pope was anxious to extend the power of the papacy into the East, where the Eastern Church had rejected the supremacy of the Pope. He was also using the Crusades as a way of declaring his superiority and supremacy over the secular rulers, the kings, who were supposed to be calling wars, not the Pope. But the interesting thing, in my view, about the Crusades is that when they arrived in Jerusalem, of course, you know, there was an absolute horrible massacre. By that time, the Crusaders were absolutely, they were half starved, half out of their minds. They'd had 3 years on the road, very little food, traumatic years. They were not in their right mind, one can say that for them, but it was a terrible catastrophe. You can never take ancient numbers as accurate, but it's said that 30,000 people were killed in 2 days. Now, you'd think, given that we think that Islam is a religion that is so addicted to jihad, that its whole raison d'etre is the holy war, you'd think that after this terrific onslaught, they'd have been out in force to eradicate the Crusaders. And ISIL would have nothing on the wrath that would have been unleashed by the entire Muslim world as the third city in the holy in Islam is sacked. Not a bit of it. For the first 50 years, the Muslims simply sort of, they deplored what had happened. They'd never seen anything like this Western violence. In the chroniclers are just aghast. But basically, they just settled down, and the emirs went on fighting one another for land and territory as usual, making treaties with the Crusaders against one another. It was the Second Crusade that convinced them that the Franks were a bit of a menace. And even then, it took Nur ad-Din and Salah ad-Din a huge Herculean effort to get the idea of jihad off the ground. The idea was dead. It had died. And it was revived, and it's never gone away again, as the result of a sustained Western assault. Now, jihad. Again, people seem to think that the Quran is maniacally intent on jihad. In fact, the word jihad and its derivatives occurs only 44 times in the Quran. And in only 10 of those cases does it refer unequivocally to warfare. It's a struggle. The word means struggle and an effort, an endeavor. And it is a struggle to give people who are hungry something to eat when you yourself have very little. This is a struggle, as just as much as fighting may have needed to be. Now, the same applies today with our... Let me just take the phenomenon of suicide bombing. Suicide bombing, people have said to me. In fact, I think my former editor at Bodley Head said in worried tones, well, Karen, they did it for God, don't they? Really, I'll tell you, I tried for 7 years as a nun to do things purely for God. And I found it completely impossible. This is not the way our human motivation works. But in fact, suicide bombing was the invention of the Tamil Tigers, a virulently secular organization. Though it first hit the world in the Middle East with a Shiite attack in Lebanon, in fact, most of the attacks, the suicide attacks in Lebanon during the 1980s, were committed by secularists, socialists, and secularists from Syria. Only about 7 were committed by Muslims, and it was about 27 by these secularists. Robert Pape, a scholar in Chicago University, has made a study of every suicide bombing attack from 1980 to 2004. And he concluded that this has nothing to do, as he said, and I quote him here, with Islamic fundamentalism or any religious tradition for that matter. It occurs when people see that what they regard as their homeland invaded by a foreign power, usually a foreign power with great superior weaponry, a superpower, in fact, like the Americans and also like the Israelis. And that is certainly the case with the Tamil Tigers too. If you listen to the martyr videos made by Hamas before they gave it up, it's really interesting to see how these young kids segue quite naturally and easily from "we're going now to meet the Lord of the worlds" typical Muslim, into we are doing this for the liberation of Palestine, then into a third world spiel about how they want to be a vanguard of people who are all the people who are oppressed by Western imperialism, back to God, back to... It segues completely between the three. People have... forensic scientists have done surveys... On survivors of suicide attacks, and one in particular, a forensic psychologist who's also a former CIA officer, interviewed all the surviving members of the 9/11 attack involvement in prison. And he found that of those, only about 25% had had a regular Muslim upbringing. Most of them had been to secular schools. A lot of them had been non-observant before they sort of arrived at this horrifying decision. And many were converts. And he concluded that really the problem was not Islam, but rather ignorance of Islam. And many of them only start reading the Quran seriously when they're in prison. In July, two of the young men who left Birmingham to go to Syria and who pleaded guilty to terrorist charges in just a couple of months ago had ordered from Amazon two books. One was Islam for Dummies. The other was The Quran for Dummies. This is, I think, I can see I'm coming to the end of my... 20 minutes, and there's so much to say. But one of these surveys has concluded that by far the biggest motivating force, especially for young people in Saudi Arabia, going first to the Soviet war in Afghanistan, then to the Al-Qaeda camps, was always the spectacles of Muslim suffering that were being beamed into their homes almost nightly on the television, from Chechnya, from Palestine, from Lebanon. In the 1980s, think of all the things that happened, the Sabra and Shatila massacre. And every single one of them was saying that they wanted to go to help their brothers and sisters. It's much the same impulse that made Jews from all over the diaspora flock to Israel in 1967 at the start of the Six-Day War. And or in 1938, when young men upped and went to the Spanish Civil War to fight the fascists. That same desire. Young men like fighting. That there is that too. Young men, and one our fellow host on Start the Week the other morning, a military historian, said boredom is one of the main factors that drives people to war. But also in the Muslim world, this concern for the suffering of Muslims. We don't see these images. We might see the odd one or two. But I've seen some of these promotional videos. And there are piles of dead bodies here. There are Israeli soldiers harrying children. There are houses being bulldozed. There are massacres, horrifying scenes in Chechnya, women being raped by the Russian troops, etc. And that among these young people, a sense of acute shame that their governments were doing nothing about this. And a sense a sense of huge humiliation that this could be happening to their brothers and sisters worldwide, and nothing was being done. The world was letting it happen, it is unfortunate, therefore, that the Iraq War, when it came, just let forth a whole new range of images of suffering, for which just think of Abu Ghraib. For which the West was not just implicated, but that it was directly responsible. So, and interestingly, at these at this early stage when these people were being recruited, there was very little anti-Americanism. They would say, we did not go because of the Americans, or we went to help the people but not to fight. I didn't know how I would help the people, but I wanted to help. It's the indoctrination came in the camps in Al-Qaeda. Six American Muslims from Buffalo, New York, actually left the camp because they were so shocked by the anti-Americanism there. So I think we should bear that in mind, perhaps, as we start these airstrikes, remembering that these images of suffering are one of the biggest motivators that drive young men to war at this time. So I now look forward to some discussion about this, first with you, Tom, and then with the rest of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen. I'm sure we will come back to ISIS or ISIL and also the notion of jihad, but I wanted to start by taking you back really to your motivation. When I was reading this book, I got a very strong sense it's a very combative book in a good way. It feels as though you've said, right, the retreat has gone on long enough. We're going to dig in here and we're going to fight back. I'm curious as to who is it that you see in the trenches over there on the enemy lines, as it were.
I really hope I don't see anybody as enemies.
Opponents, then, to use a less...
Well, basically, I say at the beginning of the book that every time I jump into a London taxi, the cabbie says, what do you do for a living? And I blench slightly because I know what's coming, and sometimes I'm just tempted to say I'm a typist or something. But and he nearly always says, religion has been the cause of all the major wars in history.
I'm sure we've all been irritated by simplifications, but it's a long way to go. It's a very, very big and very scholarly book,
yes,
to refute
but
the...
But look, this happened. This is repeated like a mantra by all kinds of people who should know better. I mean, even people, dare I say it, who work for the Guardian newspaper have taken this really quite combative line. Muslims they've failed to modernize. They're stuck in this benighted religion. And I've been dealing with this now, you see, since 9/11.
Do you think there are no problems then with the Muslim religion as it is now?
No more than any other. You're thinking of religion.
No, but equally, I would say there might be problems with other religions too. You don't think that there's no problems with religion, because you've written yourself at other times,
yes,
about the cruelties that it can inflict through,
yes,
piety. This book contains many, many instances. So where for you does accusation stop and defence begin?
I think the thing to do is remember what I said at the beginning, that religion isn't this sort of essence on its own, like a chemical, and you pop it into something and goes, you know, to keep it out of politics. It goes through everything, and politics, for example, and warfare. Every state ideology before the modern period was permeated with religion. Therefore, as the state, pre-modern state, cannot exist without warfare, and without, I didn't get on to the whole structural violence of the pre-modern state, in which a small elite, 5% of the population, an aristocracy, suppress 90% of the people, take their agricultural surplus from them, force them to live at subsistence level, and use this to fund their cultural achievements. So warfare is part of that.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
You make a good case. I mean, you start in Iraq, essentially. I mean, the crucible for much of this, but a long, long time ago. You begin with Sumerian agrarians and Aryan pastoralists and so on, and the conflict between them. And you suggest at the beginning that religion emerges as an attempt to tame violence.
No, religion doesn't emerge. You're still thinking in terms of religion as something separate.
All right, then its first instinct is to tame and curb.
It is not an it that is separate. It is more a mood. If you'd said to the Sumerians, "What is religion?" they would have looked at you blankly.
All right, but it's a highly specific mood in certain times, isn't it? And it's a mood which is then collected together in scriptures.
Well, some of it is, but if you look at the scriptures, like look at the Hebrew Bible, it's full of a whole lot of stuff. I mean, Japanese scholars have looked at it, and they can't find any religion in it. It all seems to be about history and all kinds of other things.
You say that as a scholar of comparative religion.
Yes.
But it's not something that many of faith would say about their scriptures.
Not now, no.
No.
Not
but
now.
Isn't that where the problem arises?
I think, too, you've got to see that there has been a complete... We are now reading our scriptures in the modern period with a literalism that is without precedent in religious history. The whole idea of reading scripture in a literal manner, it goes back only to the 1870s. In the United States, it begins. And you would never, Muslims would never have read the Quran on its own. It always had to be read through the filter of the imams and their highly elaborate interpretations. Similarly, Jews don't read the Bible by itself. They read it through the lens of the Talmud and that whole sort of mass of Jewish jurisprudence.
Which doesn't mean that the lens can't be lethally distorting, though,
of course.
Does it? I mean, just to cite something that you taught me about reading your book, Peter the Venerable, setting off the First Crusade, expressed the hope that King Louis of France would kill as many Muslims as Moses and Joshua had killed Amorites and Canaanites. It doesn't matter whether he's thinking that's literally true or only metaphorically true. It is still a lethal doctrine, and it still sacralizes violence.
It's not a doctrine. It's not a doctrine.
A narrative, then.
It's a narrative, which, of course, the rabbis completely eviscerated in the Talmud. They turned Joshua, for example, and David into earnest, non-violent Torah scholars to try to take the violence that had led to the anti-Roman riposte. But you see, St. Bernard Peter the Venerable was not thinking of Jesus saying, "Love your enemies," also in Scripture, or Jesus saying, you know, "Forgive and turn the other cheek." He chose to go to that because he was filled with righteous wrath against the heathen who were ethnically different and far superior to, there was the same resentment of Islam, which is a far more superior civilization, as there is now in the third world, the resentment of the United States.
Part of the problem, though, is that you don't necessarily have to have the racial difference, do you? You write very interestingly about the Brahmins. I mean, it's similar to that attempt in Judaism to, as it were, take the violence out of the scriptures. And the Brahmins attempt something similar with the Vedic texts. They come along and they say, right, we've got to make these, as it were, too much damage is being done. We have to take the violence out. The problem was that, I mean, you write this, some renouncers broke even more completely with the Vedic system and were denounced as heretics by the Brahmins.
Yes.
And we all know what you can do to heretics.
Yes.
So there's a problem in the natural schismatic nature of religion.
No, it's just, look, the heretic in the modern secular nation state has been replaced by the ethnic minority. Very often these heretics were not, they didn't have theological differences. They were mostly, especially in Europe, they were protesting against the structural injustice that was emerging there, and therefore they're cut down. Henry VIII and Elizabeth all persecuted Catholics because they were traitors to the state.
Why were they conceived of as traitors to the state?
Because the state was developing sovereign powers. And in the pre-modern, before the early modern period, the ruling class expected to have a different religion from the masses.
Yes, but it still doesn't get you round the fact that their only traitorous action is to believe something different.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. It really is not. Most people.
Well, to owe their allegiance, as it were, to a different authority,
let's have a look at the Sunni Shia thing. That's not about doctrine at all. There's virtually no theological difference between the Sunni and the Shia. It begins as a profound political dispute as to who should lead the Muslim Ummah.
It's about lineage, isn't it? And
it's not just about lineage, it's about justice. And you have the complication that the Muslims were developing an empire. An empire was considered, strange as it may seem to us, to have been the best way of keeping the peace, because it meant that you have a supreme power that is able to hold warring aristocracies in check. And the Muslims had to do this, but this was utterly against the egalitarianism of the Quran. And so there were people, not just Sufis too, philosophers too, all protesting against this. And the Shia is a piety of protest, of disciplined protest against the injustice of mainstream Muslim society.
You make a very good case, I think, that if you're to make the case that religion is inherently violent, you have to selectively quote, because every single scriptural tradition will have a contradiction.
We are violent creatures.
We are violent creatures.
Therefore, our scriptures
are
violent.
But can I just ask you something about that distinction between, as it were, the moral and ethical components of all the major religions and the elements that repeatedly in history cause violence and cause violent conflict? And it's supernatural belief. I wondered, from your knowledge of history, has there ever been a violent doctrinal dispute over what it means to be generous to the poor, say?
Well, actually, most of the early heretics, as I mentioned in the book, in Europe, were protesting against the aristocracy, who were at that point creating a full-blown empire. Yes, and then the Buddhists and the Confucians are very much about the golden rule. And they are creating, throughout, a major theme in this book has been the constant attempt to create alternatives to the violence of the state in the Buddhist Sangha, deliberately designed in many ways to sort of challenge the aggressive ethos of the court. Yoga is very much about getting rid of the aggression in the mind, the egotistic me-first drive that makes us love fighting and combating, even verbally. And then you have, and then the Buddha sends them out to work for the good and welfare of humanity. The Prophet Muhammad, the Quran is an outcry against the structural injustice that is emerging in capitalist Mecca. So, and my favourite story, and I told it to you the morning, is Ashoka, a third century emperor BCE in India, who was a cruel man. He came to power by killing two of his brothers. But he went on, he accompanied the army when it was putting down a rebellious city, and he was appalled by the violence that he saw. He was horrified by seeing all these peasants being carted off away from their families to work land elsewhere in the empire. And he put up throughout his domains inscriptions on huge rock faces and massive cylindrical pillars that were uncovered in the 19th century, calling out for justice, for kindness to the poor, for tolerance, for recognizing that all sects were equally valid, all teachers must be listened to, not even those deemed heretical by the Brahmins. He is going to create clinics for the poor. He is going to put up shade trees for the refreshment of animals and humans alike. But he can never disband his army. And he cannot send back, repatriate all those peasants that he's uprooted, because they are essential to the agrarian economy. Now, this is the dilemma of civilization. And that's why these people say scornfully, well, you know, these people, like Buddhists, they were never able to succeed. But they kept up this alternative vision, this alternative outcry. And that's what we must do now in our secular world. Create mythologies, just as they did in the best of the scriptures, right from ancient Mesopotamia, that made the people aware, told stories and myths that made people aware of the profound injustice and violence that was being done to the poor and the peasants.
You brought me round to another element on, as it were, what the charge sheet against religion, and that is that it does provide an identity. And it will sometimes provide an identity when there is no other perceivable difference between a people. I mean, you write rather interestingly about this in the Peasants' War, Catholic and Protestant villages dropping their differences because they see that there is an overwhelming interest they both have in fighting against injustice.
And similarly, the kings. The kings, monarchs, were all in the wars, so-called wars of religion, Catholic and Protestant, constantly fighting their co-religionists and joining up with one another. So what about this?
Well, the point I'm trying to make is that once either the kind of Protestant, the peasant revolution has failed, or those interests, or, you know, things get back to normal, those differences will reemerge as a cause for violence and conflict,
but you see,
in themselves.
No,
I mean, this happens in... Surely you can see this in India, where you can see people and you think it is inconceivable from the outside what differences there is between them. There isn't a difference. There isn't a difference in their condition of life. There isn't a difference in their exploitation, their economic dependence. The only difference is that one is a Hindu and one is a Muslim.
Yes, and that was something that engineered, as I explain in my book, with British colonialism.
Of course, we may be guilty it remains... It was a tool that they were able to use.
Now it is. You see, and I think that one of the things that secularization has done in the Middle East and in colonial countries, secularization has often been imposed so violently that it has damaged, pushed people into a violent riposte. The Shahs used to go out with their soldiers, sending their soldiers out with their bayonets, taking the women's veils off them in the street and ripping them to pieces. In 1935, Shah Reza Pahlavi gave his soldiers orders to shoot at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western dress. Hundreds were killed that day. Nasser interred thousands of members of the Muslim Brotherhood in jail, to jail, often without mostly without trial, and often for doing nothing more incriminating than handing out leaflets. That was where you have the ideology of Sayyid Qutb emerging. Fundamentalist movement that I've studied in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, this defensive religious riposte has always begun with what is perceived to be an assault by an aggressive secularization.
Is there not also a form of secular nationalism that says, well, we don't want to extinguish the signs of your religion, you're free to carry it on?
Yes.
But you must tolerate all other religions.
Yes.
And that operates pretty well, actually.
Yes. But we've been fortunate. We've been very fortunate in our part of the world. We had our violent wars, but modernity was ours. It was something that grew organically. In other parts of the world where it's been imposed on all our ideas about democracy, are imposed, A, as a foreign import, and B, ring rather hollow, when we have been supporting people like Saddam Hussein and the Shahs of Iran, who deprive their people of basic human rights. When the human rights ethos was developed by people like Locke in the early modern period, these human rights did not apply to the people in the new world that we were just about to colonize. As Locke said, the champion of toleration and the champion of human rights, he said that a master had absolute and despotical power over a slave and could kill him at any time, and that the kings, as he called them, of America had no right to their land.
This is something one should point out, has also been said by... Yes. With religious backing and scriptural backing.
That's what. So it's no better, are we?
No, it's no better.
We're no better. So we're also proud of our human rights. Just remember that, that this rings hollow when we have just turned a blind eye to dictators who have happened to.
Would you rather live in a theocracy or in?
No, I've had no. I have no desire to live in a theocracy, but I don't like living in a secular society which sneers at religion or sneers at other cultures.
No, I can understand that, but why don't you want to live in a theocracy?
Because I lived as a nun for 7 years, and that was quite enough, believe me. And I think it's good. I say that in the book quite clearly. It's good for religion to get it out of politics, to get it out of the meshes of the state. And I think religion is at its best, not when it gets tied up with the state, with all the injustices and violence that any state will commit. No state in the world has not got blood on its hands, however secular it is. But I think the religion has a role in standing up like the prophets of Israel, like the Buddha, constantly bearing witness to the suffering and pain and saying to the kings, rulers in power, you are the man, don't do this. That should free religion for that. If religion is freed from being tied up with the ghastly mechanisms of the state, then it can perform a prophetic role.
So we'll throw it open for questions from the floor. I'm going to take this question here and then from you. Yeah.
Karen, listening to you, you seem to argue, you speak in psychological terms and you argue for a humanism. Why do we need a God?
We probably don't. Buddhists do fine without one. A God, again, is an example of how inept our theological thinking is. I don't think we do need a God, but some people find it helpful. God is only a symbol of transcendence. That's where our theology now is weak. People sort of think... we hear about God for the first time very often when we first learn about Santa Claus. And over the years, our idea of Santa Claus develops. Our religion gets stuck at this rather infantile level. The Bible is only a kind of starter kit for a sort of that takes you as pre-modern scriptural exegesis did, to take you beyond the literal text and into a sense of wonder and transcendence and awe. I think transcendence is a fact of life, but transcendence doesn't mean it means something that we can never describe or know. We all have moments of awe and wonder, and I think that you can find that in if you keep that sense of awe and wonder alive, especially in other people. The religions all tell us to look for the marvels in other people. And I think if we can see, as the Hindus at their best do when they join hands and bow, they are acknowledging the divinity that they are meeting in the other. I that's the way I see it. The God of my childhood dwindled very soon after I left my convent, but I've since found the richness in the way that concept has been developed in a sophisticated way that is often beyond the sort of public discourse.
Gentleman at the back there, yep. And am I missing anybody?
It's hard to see.
Oh, sorry, and I'll then come to you, so yeah. Sorry, yes, if you could ask your question.
Good evening.
Where is it?
There is an episode of Yes, Prime Minister, where the central joke is that the Church of England is not a religious institution but a social one. And of course, we have often seen religion playing a role in non-religious affairs. For instance, the core foundation of the Muslim Brotherhood was as a support group for poor young Muslims moving to the capitals in Egypt, and of course the Iranian ulama playing a major role in drafting the constitution in 1905 when the Qajar Shah was too busy kowtowing to Westerners. Could we not argue, therefore, that religion is just one strand of the intricate web that makes up social grievances and motivations to speak out in social grievances? And why, therefore, is religion the one that we choose to target?
Well, that's great. That's just what I've been trying to say all evening. thank you very much indeed. Couldn't have put it better myself.
Do you... Do you ever wonder about religion not as a cause of, you make a very good case for it not being the cause of violence. There's always, as it were, secondary other causes, underlying causes. What about the accusation that it's a lubricant towards violence?
What do you mean by lubricant?
That it permits, that it gives license to people to take actions which they might otherwise think twice about, because it is a sacred duty to do it, or a sacred...
Well, it can do, but you have got a whole range of ulama and people who would tell you that you're not correct in that, though they don't often get a voice. But also, secular ideologies can do this, or just sheer nihilism. Where these young men are beating up old ladies and raping them. And I don't think, they're not usually claiming that God has told them to do this, though some deranged souls may be, but there is just...
Well, then I'm trying to put the...
So here,
I'm clumsily trying to put the argument that religion is very good at making otherwise good people do bad things.
And yes, and secular states have also been very good at doing that too. The beating people up in jails and, people disappearing in jails, torture.
I'm sorry, I've jumped in, but just before I go back, you talk about those in terms of, you very often say the state is converted into an idol, the nation is made a sacred object. So you talk of them almost as quasi-religions.
Yes, but you're still thinking about religion in this.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, you need to get the lady up there to sort of put you right. The point I'm making about an idol is that this is bad religion, whether it's an innate, whether it's a national idol or a religious idol. An idol, in an idol, you are worshipping something human, or something that is human or limited, whereas an icon, you look through the icon and see transcendence. That's what a religious icon or symbol is supposed to be. They're supposed to be transparent. When they become opaque and an end in themselves, whether they're religious or secular, they're not good things.
Okay, you made that clear. We're not here for my religious education, and I jumped in, I'm afraid, so if we could go back.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to ask you, not directly about religion, but about violence.
Mm-hmm.
And you said a number of times that, we're all violent, we all like to hate. Well, there's actually a great deal of evidence that that's not true, that humans are hardwired for solidarity and sociability and cooperation, and violence is difficult. And there was evidence, for example, psychological evidence from the 1950s that worried the American military, because they found that a lot of soldiers in face-to-face combat tried to fire to miss their opponents and didn't want to kill them. And so violence is difficult, and people have to be persuaded to be violent and have to overcome inhibitions to violence. And I think in a way it's not unlike perhaps the point Tom made just now, that religion might, amongst many other things, racism would be another one, religion, amongst many other things, might be a way of creating difference between people in which you see the opponent as someone who it is legitimate to kill. Now, in your response just now to Tom, I think you started to make a distinction between good and bad religion. So your answer was, yes, but if religion permits that, it's bad religion. But surely you've got to take religion in the round and say, well, this is what religion can do.
Well, you see, there isn't an it. But I entirely agree with you about... I have actually talked about all this, about this. There seems to be an evolutionary mechanism that makes us extremely reluctant to kill our own kind, because obviously it's not smart to kill off your species if you wanted to survive. And we are certainly wired for empathy. And you're certainly right, and I do talk about this, we just haven't touched on it tonight, that in order to kill, a soldier has to become sort of almost dehumanized in a way. And hence the training with not dissimilar to the sort of training we were given in my convent, I have to say, to be depersonalized and told to do one thing one day and then another thing the next day and that kind of thing, so that you become an automatic, you will perform automatically on the battlefield, certainly religion has been used for that, but so have other national differences too. What we have to do really is to make the enemy inhuman so that we don't kill him or her. So that process of dehumanization, we have to dehumanize ourselves in order to fight them, to shoot at them directly. Hence, the boon to warfare of modern weaponry that means you can kill at a distance and not see the result of your actions. They found in World War II that people who could see the people they were killing suffered huge guilt, but as you went up in the air and got higher and higher and you didn't see them, that reluctance went. This is all, you're quite right to bring this out, thank you. This is all very complicated, and religion has been used for that, but so have other non-religious anti-religious ideologies.
Yes, in the front here.
How do you feel about Sam Harris's distinction between religion and spirituality?
I know a lot of people like this distinction. I don't get it, I have to say, really. A lot of people like to say, well, I'm not religious, you know, that's pretty, but I am very spiritual. There's a certain sort of congratulatory element in some of it, and I'm not really in favour of. Who knows? I'm not, dousing everybody who says that, obviously, because what do I know? But I think some of the traditions, as they've developed, ask hard things of you, like love your enemy, like give what you have, even when you have little yourself, to someone who else who is in need. These hard things, to go out into the world, says the Buddha, and don't just sit hugging your nice, warm, spiritual glow.
You associate those hard questions with religion, not with spirituality.
Well, I don't see the difference, really. But some people like to make that difference because they hate religion, but they can bask in being spiritual. But I think if you're hating anybody or anything, you're not really spiritual.
One gentleman here and then up, and then I think we'll be finished.
Do you hold religion responsible for any violence at all?
Yes, of course. But it's not, certainly. But it's usually mixed up with a whole lot of other stuff too. You rarely do things simply for religion. Think about your own motivation, even in important issues, like why you take that job. And, you know, you've got a whole lot of rational reasons, but there's all kinds of muddly little idiotic things. So why you're marrying this person, or why you go into a convent, indeed. It was certainly not... I mean, I was aware, painfully aware, there are a whole lot of other reasons that were putting me in there that had nothing to do with religion. Pardon? Oh, but they were protesting. They were protesting against dissidents more than their religious ideas. The Cathars were creating a huge... I write about them, of course, a huge social protest. They were preaching poverty, going back to apostolic property, very embarrassing for the rich clergy who are all sitting in wealth and palaces. They were dangerous religious, and they're non-violent at a time when the Crusades are going on. They are eschewing all violence and giving their property to the poor, just as Jesus said. This is most uncomfortable, and they're getting a huge following. And they are. And this is the time when the Pope is the monarch of Europe, Innocent III, the Pope who achieved papal monarchy. So he was like the emperor. After that, the papacy goes downhill and the secular...
I'm just going to cut in on the Cathars because I'm conscious that we're running out of time. I don't know whether you've got microphones yet there. Yes, you have.
I understand and I appreciate that you have emphasised that the suffering of Muslims as a result of some of the actions by the Western powers has created a feeling, and this resentment has boiled over and all that sort of thing. But I want to just link it to a slightly different one. If you look at the Muslim societies, all societies where Muslims are in majority, the first thing in most of them they do is they declare an Islamic Republic. And it is written into the very structure, the foundation of an Islamic Republic, that the rights of almost all the non-Muslims are either disregarded, ignored, or simply they are banished. So Islam, it comes back to Islam. If Islam is the authority which gives the Islamic State, whether it's Iran, whether it's Pakistan, whether it's Bangladesh, whether anywhere else, to make sure that the rights of non-Muslims are simply abolished, or if not, they are made into second-rate. The problem at the moment is, I have great sympathy with the Muslim suffering, but the Muslims, wherever they are, they want to make sure that wherever they are a minority, there is no suffering inflicted on them. But wherever they are in a majority, they will come down like hammer and tongs and extinguish your rights. That's why I would say dissociate religion from political power. Because in Islamic world, this is inevitably going to mean that the non-Muslims will be either persecuted or be ignored or be made second-class citizen, and that is justified by the Holy Book.
Actually, it isn't. This was a ruling. The whole what you're thinking of the Dhimmi system, created in the 8th century by a jurist called Al-Shafi, which was a typical. This applied to every single empire. It had a dualist. Every single empire, whether it was Persians, Romans, the lot. The imperial ideology demands three things. It demands, one, that you have a sort of a mission to the world. Two, that you have a dualistic view of the world. Empire and we are good, others are second class. The third is that you are actually benefiting the whole of mankind by what you're doing. Everyone did this, the Romans, the lot. This was a typical... It's not in the Holy Book. The Quran is essential. Reach out to all tribes and nations. That there is no compulsion in religion.
Well, there's also the sword verse.
That's when he was fighting. But there's one sword verse to much of the other stuff.
The trouble is that people only read the sword verse.
Yes, and that's part of the problem, that these uneducated people who haven't read the whole Quran therefore get tied up on, and that's a very convenient thing. You couldn't read the Quran in the old days. You listened to it, and you listened to what was the whole of the scripture. So this also applies to every single nation state too. And the Achilles heel of the nation state has been its treatment of minorities. Lord Acton pointed this out in the late 19th century. He said that the stress on ethnicity, on a certain cultural allegiance, and on language would make people who did not fit the national profile very vulnerable. And we've seen what happened in the Holocaust, for example, the most hideous example of what can happen when the nation itself, with this stress on ethnicity, language, and culture, becomes the supreme marker.
Okay, just very quick question. It'll have to be, I'm afraid.
And a quick answer, I guess.
Yeah, and a quick answer, yeah.
What do you think of Caudaism?
What?
Caudaism.
Never heard of it.
What is It's probably going to take too long to explain. I'm going to have to stop there because we haven't finished, but we have run out of time.
What are you doing right now? Perhaps you're in the supermarket. Maybe you're on a run or on the commute. But wherever you are in the world, and whatever you're doing, right now you're also listening to my voice. This is the power of podcasts. The ability to communicate with your audience in an intimate and intentional way through audio. I'm Bea Duncan, Senior Partnerships Producer at Intelligence Squared. We've been a world-leading forum for talks, debates, and events for over two decades. And we also use our cutting-edge curation, creativity, and editorial expertise to elevate your brand to new audiences with podcasting. Intrigued? To find out what we can do for your organization, book into a free consultation with me today. Find out more by going to www.intelligencesquared.com/partnerships.